Chapter 29. Murphy grabbed a gym bag out of her car and then followed me to Ebenezer's truck. She stopped about 20 feet short of it and said, "You're kidding me." "Come on," I said. "You want to show up where there might be some trouble in your own car? That'd be nice for the responding emergency units to see. So get in." "What does it run on? Coal?" Ebenezer stuck his bald head out of the window, scowling. "No idea. Mostly I just turn it loose to hunt down dinner for itself." "Murph," I said, "this is Ebenezer McCoy. Ebenezer, this is Karen Murphy." "You," Ebenezer said, without approval. "I heard you've given the boy a hard time." Murphy scowled. "Who the hell are you?"
"My teacher," I told her in a quieter voice. "A friend."
She glanced at me, then pursed her lips. She didn't miss the shotgun or the staff in the truck.
"You're coming along to help?"
"As long as you don't think I'm too old, girlie," he drawled, heavy on the sarcasm.
"You got a driver's license? You driven Chicago streets lately?" The old wizard scowled at her.
"Thought so," she said. "Move over."
He sputtered.
"What?"
"I'm driving," she said. "So move." I sighed.
"Better move over, sir," I told Ebenezer. "We're in a hurry."
Murphy's gym bag thumped onto the ground, and she stared at me with her mouth open.
"What?"
I asked.
"Sir?"
she said, her voice incredulous. I scowled at her and ducked my head. She picked up her bag, blinked a couple of times, and said in her professionally politest tones, "If you don't mind, Mr. McCoy, I know the streets better, and there are lives at stake." Ebenezer's scowl had been half subverted by a small smile, but he said,
"Bah, I'm too old to see the street signs anyway."
He opened the door and started scooting.
"Get in, get in. Come on, Hoss, we ain't got time to wait on you."
Murphy did not go so far as to slap her magnetic cop light on the top of the truck, but she got us to a parking garage near Mavra's lair in a big hurry. She knew the streets of the old town as well as anyone I'd ever seen, and she regarded niceties like red lights, one-way streets, and right-of-way with an almost magnificent lack of concern. Ebenezer's old truck kept up with her gamely enough, though I found my head bouncing off the roof a couple of times. I told Murphy what I'd learned about the vampire's lair on the way. Murphy shook her head.
"Damn, this isn't what I expected, that they take something right in the middle of so many people."
"Me either," I said. "But that only means we need to move sooner instead of later. The longer the vamps are there, the more of those hostages they're going to bleed out, and the greater the risk of one of their Renfields snapping and opening up on pedestrians with an assault rifle."
"Assault rifles," Murphy said, "and hostages. Jesus, Harry, people could die."
"No could about it. They're already dying," I replied. "At least 3 bodies already, and the Renfields are just a matter of time."
"What if you're wrong?" Murphy said.
"Do you really expect me to charge in, guns blazing, against people who might or might not already be dead? I have an obligation to protect citizens, not to sacrifice them." My teeth clacked together as the truck went over a heavy bump. "These are the Black Court. They kill, and they do it frequently. Not only that, but they can propagate their kind more rapidly than any other vampire. If we let a nest of them go unmolested, we could potentially have dozens of them in a few days. In 2 weeks, there could be hundreds. Something has to be done, and now." Murphy shook her head.
"But it doesn't mean it needs to be vigilante work. Harry, give me 3 hours to establish probable cause, and I'll have every cop and every SWAT team in 200 miles ready to take on that nest."
"And you'll tell them what, exactly?" I said. "Basement full of vampires is not going to cut it, and you know it. And if they go in with blinders on, cops will get killed."
"And if it's us?" Murphy asked.
"What then? We kick down the door, shoot anything standing, and then make like we're the flying Van Helsings? A direct assault on a wary target is one of the best ways in the world to get killed."
"So we figure something out," I said. "We get a plan."
Murphy shot me a look past Ebenezer, who evidently had decided to stay out of it.
"This isn't like the Walmart plan with the marbles, is it?"
"I'll tell you when I know. Let's get there and see if we can find out first. Maybe Kincaid will have something."
"Yeah," Murphy said without much hope.
"Maybe. Here, this is where Kincaid is meeting us."
It wasn't a pleasant neighborhood. The city had been working on urban renewal projects for decades, but the lion's share of the money had gone to restore higher-profile, more infamous neighborhoods, such as Cabrini Green. In that time, many neighborhoods that had been borderline steadily eroded and had usurped the infamous neighborhood crown. The slum is dead. Long live the slum. I'd seen worse, but not many. Tall buildings and narrow alleys choked out a lot of the sunshine. Most windows below the third or fourth floor had been boarded up. Ground-level commercial properties were largely vacant. The storm drains were clogged with litter and other urban detritus. Most of the streetlights were out, and graffiti and gang signs had been spray-painted everywhere. The air smelled like mildew, garbage, and exhaust. The residents of the neighborhood moved with brisk purpose, confidence, and flat eyes as they walked, doing everything they could to indicate by body language that they were not good targets for assault or robbery. I spotted a drug house in the first 10 seconds of looking around. The burned-out hulk of an abandoned car had been stripped for parts before it had been set on fire, and I had a notion that Murphy was the first cop to visit in the past several weeks. But there was something missing. Bums. Transients. Homeless folk. Winos. Bag ladies. Even in broad daylight, there should have been someone collecting cans, panhandling change, or shambling along drinking from a bottle still covered with a paper bag. But there wasn't. Everyone moving was getting from one place to another, not eking out a living from the environment. "Look kind of quiet to you here?" Murphy asked, voice tight. "Yeah," I said. "They've been killing," she said, almost spitting the words.
"Maybe, maybe not," Ebenezer said.
I nodded. "There's dark power at work here. People sense that, even if they don't know what it is. You're feeling it now." "What do you mean?" I shrugged. "The presence of dark magic. It makes you feel nervous and angry. If you forced yourself to calm down and try to sense it, you could feel it. It leaves a kind of stain around it."
"Stinks," rumbled Ebenezer.
"What does that have to do with missing street people?" Murphy asked. "You've been here about 3 minutes, and the power bothers you already. Imagine living in it, getting a little more afraid every day, angrier, more demoralized. People get rattled enough to leave, even if they don't understand why. Over the long term, this kind of power breeds its own wasteland."
"You mean that the vampires have been here for a while?" she asked.
"To have this much effect, it's been days at least," I said, nodding.
"More like 2 weeks," Ebenezer grunted with assurance. "Maybe 3.
"God," Murphy said, shivering. "That's scary."
"Yeah. If they've been here that long, it means Mavra has something in mind." She frowned.
"You mean that this vampire came here and then chose when to make you aware of its presence? This could be a trap."
"It's possible. Paranoid, but possible." Her mouth tightened into a line.
"You didn't mention that at breakfast."
"We're doing battle with the living dead, Murph. Expect the occasional curveball."
"Are you patronizing me now?"
I shook my head.
"No. Honest." "Where's Kincaid?"
"Second level of this parking garage," Murphy said. "Stop on the first level," I told her.
"Why?"
"He doesn't know about Ebenezer, and I don't want to spook him. We'll walk up and meet him." Ebenezer nodded to us and said,
"Good call, Hoss. Decent gunman can be twitchy. I'll give you a minute, then drive on up."
Murphy stopped the truck and we got out. I waited until we were several paces from the truck before I lowered my voice and said,
"I know. You're afraid."
She glared at me and started to deny it, but she knew better and shrugged one shoulder instead.
"Some."
"So am I. It's okay."
"I thought I was over this," she said.
Her jaw tightened.
"I mean, the night terrors are gone. I can sleep again, but it isn't like before, Harry. I used to get scared, but I'd be excited, too. I would have wanted to do it. But I don't want this. I'm so afraid that I'm about to throw up, which sucks."
"You're scared because you've learned things," I told her. "You know the kinds of things you're fighting," I said. "You know what could happen. You'd be an idiot if you weren't afraid. I wouldn't want someone with me who didn't have enough sense to be worried. She nodded, but asked, What if I freeze up on you again?
You won't.
It could happen.
It won't, I said.
You sure?
I winked at her and twirled my staff in one hand.
I wouldn't be betting my life on it otherwise. You've got my back, Murph. Shut up and dance.
She nodded, her expression remote. There's nothing we can do to stop these things.
The we had changed. She meant the police.
No, not without getting a lot of good cops killed.
Those people with the vampires, these Renfields. We'll have to kill some of them, won't we?
Probably, I said in a quiet voice.
It isn't their fault they were taken.
I know. We'll do whatever we can to avoid killing them, but from what I know about them, they're too far gone to leave us many options.
Do you remember Agent Wilson? Murphy asked.
The Fed you shot off my back?
Murph's expression flickered, though it wasn't quite a flinch.
Yeah. He went outside the law to bring down the people he thought were beyond its reach.
And now, we're making that same choice.
No, we aren't, I said.
No? Why not?
Because they aren't people. Murphy frowned. I thought about it. Even if they were, assuming they were still as dangerous and untouchable, would it change anything?
I don't know, she said. That's what scares me.
For as long as I'd known her, Murphy had upheld the law. She had a good head on her shoulders when it came to the nature of good and evil and of right and wrong, but her first duty had been to the law. She believed in it, that it was the best way to help and protect her fellow man. She'd had faith that the power of the law, while imperfect, was absolute, almost holy. It was a rallying point in her soul, a foundation block of her strength. But several years of staring out of the darkness had showed her that the law was both blind and deaf to some of the nastier parts of the world. She'd seen things that moved in the shadows, perverting the purpose of the law to use it as a weapon against the people she had sworn to defend. Her faith had taken a beating, or she wouldn't even have considered stepping outside the boundaries of her authority, and she knew it. That knowledge cost her dearly. There weren't any tears in her eyes, but I knew that they were there, on the inside, while she mourned the death of her faith.
I don't know the right thing to do, she said.
Neither do I said. But someone has to do something, and we're the only ones around. Either we choose to take a stand now, or we choose to stand around at all the funerals, regretting it later.
Yeah, Murphy said. She took a deep, almost meditative breath. I guess I needed to hear that said out loud.
A small but violent light flared to life behind her eyes.
Let's go. I'm ready.
Murph, I said. She tilted her head and looked at me. My lips suddenly felt very dry.
You look good in the dress.
Her eyes shone.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
The eye contact got dangerously intense, and I shied off. Murphy let out a low, quiet laugh and touched the side of my face. Her fingers were warm, the touch light and delicate.
Thank you, Harry.
We came up to the second level of the garage together, walking with businesslike strides. The lights were out. In the depths of shadows, I could see two vans parked side by side. The first one was a beat-up old fossil of a vehicle, born in an era when people would have thought it absurd to make a van mini. A Red Cross decal on the driver's door proclaimed its identity. The second was a white rental van. We approached, and Kincaid slid the side door open. I couldn't see him very well in the shadows.
"Didn't take long," he commented. "You walk fast."
"Wheelman's here," I said. "He's coming up in an old Ford truck in a minute. Wanted to let you know first." Kincaid glanced at the ramp and nodded.
"Fine. What do we know?"
I told him. He took it all in without speaking, glanced once at the map Bob had drawn me, and said,
"Suicide."
"Eh?" I said. Kincaid shrugged.
"We go in there guns blazing, we're gonna get burned 2 feet from the door."
"I tried to tell him that," Murphy said.
So we get a plan, I said. Any suggestions?
Blow up the building, Kincaid said without looking up. That works good for vampires. Then soak what's left in gasoline, set it on fire, then blow it all up again.
For future reference, I was sort of hoping for a suggestion that didn't sound like it came from that Bolshevik Muppet with all the dynamite.
Check, Kincaid said.
I peered at the van. Hey, where are the Red Cross people?
I killed and dismembered them, Kincaid said.
I blinked.
Kincaid stared at me for a second. That was a joke.
Right, I said. Sorry. Now, where are they?
On their lunch break. They somehow got the idea that I was a cop and that they would interfere with a sting if they went into the shelter. I gave them a C-note and told them to go grab lunch.
They believed you?
I asked. They somehow got the idea that I had a badge.
Murphy eyed Kincaid. That's the kind of thing that's illegal to own. Kincaid turned to Dig in the white van.
Sorry if I came afoul of your sensibilities, Lieutenant. Next time I'll let them walk in and get killed.
I added the 100 to your bill, Dresden. A dark jacket with a Red Cross logo on the shoulder flew out of the van and hit Murphy in the chest. She caught it, and a second later caught the matching baseball cap that followed.
Put them on, Kincaid said. Our ticket to get close enough to get the drop on them. Maybe even get some walking targets out of the way.
Where did you get those? I asked. Kincaid leaned out of the van, enough to arch an eyebrow at me.
Found them.
Kincaid, Murphy said, give me the keys to the Red Cross van.
Why?
So I can change, Murphy said, her voice tight. Kincaid shook his head.
You got nothing everyone here hasn't seen before, Lieutenant, he said.
After a moment he glanced at me and said,
Unless...
Yes, I said through clenched teeth, I've seen that sort of thing. It's been a while, but I dimly remember.
Just checking, Kincaid said.
Now give her the damn keys.
Yezza, Massa Dresden,
he said laconically and tossed a ring with only two keys at Murphy. She caught it, let out a growling sound, and stalked over to the Red Cross van. She opened it and climbed in.
Not bad, Kincaid said,
low enough that Murphy wouldn't have heard him. He kept rooting around in the minivan, evidently without feeling any need for a light.
Her in a dress, I mean. Makes you notice she's a woman.
Shut up, Kincaid. I could hear the wolfish smile, even if I couldn't see it.
Yezza. Now don't look. I'm getting dressed and I blush easy.
Blow me, Kincaid, I growled.
Don't you owe me enough already?
I heard him moving around.
You give any more thought to shutting down Mauver's sorcery?
Yeah, I said. Ebenezer's truck growled as it changed gears. Our wheelman is going to handle it.
You sure he can?
Yeah, I said. Here he comes. Kincaid stepped out of the van with guns strapped all over attachment points on a suit of black ballistic body armor that looked a generation or two ahead of the latest police issue. He had one set of big-ass revolvers, a couple of those tiny deadly machine guns that shoot so fast they sound like a bandsaw, and a bunch of automatics. They all came in matching pairs, presumably because he had an audition for the lead in a John Woo movie later that day. Kincaid donned a second Red Cross jacket to help hide all the weaponry and added his own matching cap like Murphy's. He watched Ebenezer's truck coming and said,
So, who is this guy?
Just then, Ebenezer's truck rolled up, its headlights in our eyes until it had all but passed.
So, Hoss,
Ebenezer was saying through the open window, who is this hired gun? The old man and the mercenary saw one another and stared at each other from maybe 7 or 8 feet apart. Time stopped for one of those frozen, crystallized instants. And then both of them went for their guns,